You're with The Mixtape. I'm Kirsten Johnstone, and our selector today is Diane Swan from The Bads. Kia ora.
Kia ora, Kirsten. How you doing?
Good. Now, you're well known for your stint in 80s supergroup When the Cat's Away, and you fronted indie band The Julie Dolphin in the 90s, who supported bands like The Pixies, Green Day, Radiohead. And we're going to hear stories all about those heady times during this mixtape.
Yeah, I sort of go all over the place, don't I?
This mustn't have been an easy mixtape for you to nail down.
No, really, really difficult because, for a few reasons, just because how do you choose six songs in a life? My life's kind of gone on a bit, which is good. And also because I listen to a lot of new stuff too. So I decided just to try and let my brain relax and think of times where songs have kind of been important.
When did music first come into your life? Like, when do you remember first being affected by it?
My family, I've come from quite a large family, so there was always music around. You know, when you've got older siblings, there's, you know, my mum and dad were big music fans. My siblings all bought albums. Every Christmas we were given albums and singles and things. So there was just constantly a lot of noise and music in our house. So my mum tells me that she wished music upon me when I was in her womb. She said, "You're going to be my little singer," which is kind of weird because she wasn't kind of like a proactive tennis type mum. She didn't kind of like push me, but she kind of said that she willed it when she was pregnant with me. So that's kind of weird.
One of her favourites was the first song on your mixtape, Diane, Dusty Springfield.
Yeah. Man, this song, I just don't know what to do with myself. I think this is the first time that I remember just being bowled over by the emotion of music, just the power of her voice, and also the way the strings come in and the way the bridge or the chorus, you know, build. I remember feeling like just so emotional about it, really at a very young age. And there's no way that I could have understood what she was actually singing about. But it was just the power of that emotion in the song.
I just don't know what to do with myself. Don't know just what to do with myself. I'm so used to doing everything with you. Planning everything for two. And now I just don't know what to do with my time. I'm so lonesome for you, it's a crime. Going to a movie only makes me sad. Parties make me feel as bad when I'm not with you. I just don't know what to do. Like a summer rose, it's a sun and rain. I need your sweet love to be all okay. I just don't know what to do with myself. I just don't. Baby, if you knew love ever turned to dust.
Dusty Springfield, I Just Don't Know What To Do With Myself. What a cracker of a first song to put on a mixtape, Diane Swan.
How do you follow that, really? Over, goodbye.
She's got such an incredible voice.
I know. And that's just, yeah, I'm still floored by it, actually, no matter how many times I hear it.
I feel ashamed that I haven't played this to my kids, actually. I can imagine my 7-year-old flopping around the living room singing, I just don't know what to do with myself. I'm so bored, Mum.
I think I sort of used to go really stupid on that Like a Summer Rose bit, like really melodramatic.
What kind of a kid were you? Were you that melodramatic kid?
No, really, number 4 of 5 children, so pretty quiet, but quiet outside of the home, you know, kind of very shy, but my mum sort of never believed that because at home she thought I was kind of kooky and quirky. I don't know, probably creative, a little bit...
Dreamy.
Dreamy. That's the thing. My family still tease me about the way my eyes used to glaze over when I was kind of doing the dishes, and they knew that I was thinking about something kind of arty and dreamy. You know, I still get a hard time about that.
You also played tennis, though.
Yeah, that was kind of further on down the track. At high school, I sort of got a little bit obsessed. The only things that I liked were tennis and music, and I used to play before school. During school, after school.
There's a fantastic press photo of your first serious band, Everything That Flies, from, I think, 1986 or around about. And you're in the usual, you know, 80s power dress. You know, you've got this big suit with big shoulder pads. It's white. It's belted up. You've got shorts and lacy tights on. And then you've got this tennis band around your forehead.
I think that was supposed to... See, that was odd for me because it was sort of weird. I was so much not like that. You know, I was the kid that wore the lumberjack shirts and the jeans and stuff. And I think it was just that thing that I stumbled upon a group of people that were into making their first videos. And so it was Kerry Brown, and he was in with the, Nyla Dixon and all the stylists and Megan Douglas. And I got dressed up, you know. They dressed me up like a little doll. And at first it was totally weird, but then I kind of, because I was a fairly shy person, I kind of learnt to take that on and to use it. And I remember having that particular photo taken, and I felt like, whoa, this is full on. Is this me? I don't know. I kept the silk boxer shorts and the lacy tights and the little boots, but the power jacket was kind of odd for me.
How old would you have been then?
Early 20s.
Yeah. So tell me about starting that band, Everything That Flies.
When I was at school, it was kind of, I didn't really know many people at all that were into music, and it was kind of odd because my musical tastes was totally at odds with the people that I went to school with.
This is in Whangarei that you went to
school. Yeah, in Whangarei. Yep. And in Kamo, actually, which is a suburb of Whangarei, but at the time it was kind of like a little town attached, satellite town. So I kind of befriended some older guys that had a band on the corner of our street, as you would if you were into music. And that was the first time I ever sang or played in a band was at that time when I was about 14. And they were, you know, quite a lot older. So they were into sort of music that was not of my age group, probably. You know, when I was 14, I really remember listening to things like Neil Young, Tonight's the Night, and while my school friends were listening to ABBA, and it was kind of, painting the picture of a little misfit. So I actually went on to form a band with a couple of those people, and that became Everything That Flies a little bit later down the track.
Yeah.
I was the main songwriter for that band. We recorded that first EP in downtime. So we'd be working all day and then going to the studio, and because you could get a studio really cheap in the evenings, we were doing that and then going to work the next day. So that was totally self-financed and self-propelled.
And when you say the evenings, you mean sort of post-midnight.
I mean starting maybe 8 and going all night and then going to work the next day. So it was pretty dedicated.
You got a New Zealand Music Award that year, 1985, for Most Promising Vocalist and Group.
Yep.
Must have been encouraging.
Yep, pretty much. And again, just totally blown away and shy and feeling overwhelmed by being at those awards and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. You had a song on the Everything That Flies album called Rapist.
It's
kind of Cure-like in its somberness about, you know, how you can't walk by yourself after dark. It was, you know, written back then, but honestly, if somebody released it yesterday, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yes, yeah, I took that further, and actually when we were in the Julie Dolphin, reworked it and called it Snake.
Ah.
Because the first, I felt like maybe Rapist is possibly not the best title.
I could imagine it being a little bit difficult for the industry at the time to swallow.
Yeah. So the first line is, you're like a snake around my neck. So I called the song, the Julie Dolphin performed it as Snake. So the song travelled. But yeah, it is a song that I really felt absolutely so strongly about doing. So it does come from a kind of a near miss in a situation like that when I was pretty young.
Wondering where you want to go next with this mixtape. I know that Patti Smith around that time in your life was a huge influence. Should we go there?
Yeah, okay, that's a good idea. So basically that's from my lounge room when I was growing up, when I was still at high school. And I was watching, you know, everybody watched Radio with Pictures. That was just unbelievable. Everybody was in their lounge watching Radio with Pictures on a Sunday night.
And was Karen Hay fronting it at that stage?
I think she was. Maybe slightly just before then, but it would have been around the time that she started at Radio with Pictures. Mm. But whoever it was introduced Patti Smith doing 25th Floor. And there she is. She's got this kind of like men's suit jacket on, a felt hat, and she's playing a black and white Stratocaster and just bowled me over. She does this amazing one note solo through the, well, I don't know if it's her playing it, but it, basically in the video she is, and just the attitude, it got me. I want to do that.
We're going to hear a song that she actually released quite recently. April Fool came out,
2012, I think.
Yeah, 2012.
I think. I chose that one because Patti constantly kicks me up the ass and says, come on. And I read her books. You know, I follow her Instagram. That's as inspiring as anything. She's just a person that does stuff, you know. And when you get older and you're in the music industry, it's so easy to start feeling pretty, especially as a woman in the industry, as an older woman in the industry, you kind of feel the pressure to give up. You really do. It's kind of, isn't it about time you just went away?
Do you think that that's coming externally, or do you think that it's coming internally?
I think it's pretty much both. I've had a whole lot of patronising kind of good on yous from people in the industry, you know, like, still doing it, eh? Yeah, good on you. You know, even right down to going into a music shop to buy a guitar strap, you know, it's like, is this for you, or is it for your son or your husband? Or you say, no, it's for me. Good on you. It's a look, it's a tone of voice. It's pretty hard to explain. It's not going to stop me, but man, some days it feels like, what am I doing? So people like Patti, when you see her out there and she's got her long flowing grey hair and
she
she's
must be
still breaking guitar strings.
70, 70?
Yeah. She's definitely in her 70s. And you see her just out there, still involved, still interested, still just lapping everything up, and you just think, yep, that's the way to be.
Let's hear it. This is Patti Smith, April Fool.
Come, be my April Fool. Come, you're the only one. Come, on your rusted bike. Come. Ride like riders ride, neither rich nor broke.
That is Patti Smith, April Fool, from her 2012 album Banger. And I think both me and Diane Swan, the mixtape selector today, are hoping that she'll come over to New Zealand in March when she's also playing Bluesfest in Australia.
Imagine. That'd be so great.
We mentioned the 1985 New Zealand Music Awards, and I believe it's at that party that When the Cat's Away were conceived as an idea. Were you part of that conversation?
Yeah, that is absolutely true. There's kind of some weird perception that this was a artificially put together band, but no, it was from that music awards where we kind of was just people running around and the usual things happening at music awards. And I don't think I've been to one music awards where people don't kind of say, "Hey, let's do something together. Let's," sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't. And this time it actually did happen. And it was pretty much the concept of just getting together and playing some songs that you love and having a bit of a laugh and maybe doing a gig or two. And that's how it started.
I wondered if it was reactionary. Here's five women getting together in a pretty male-centric industry.
Yeah. There were a lot of factors going on. I think people were really, things were a bit grim around that time. People were ready to have some fun as far as audiences and musicians go. And that's kind of that, I think it was that aspect that I remember of the early Cats Away days the most, is the humour. We had stupid costume changes. There was a lot of it was a very funny show right at the beginning. I think that's kind of part of the reason that it was kind of successful on all levels, from our point of view and the audience's point of view.
When you say the scene was grim at the time, what are you talking about?
I'm talking about the world at that time seemed fairly dark, and also it seemed hard to get gigs. It seemed hard to be played on the radio. It wasn't easy, put it that way. We did a lot of touring, I must say, though. The touring scene was pretty healthy in that there were a lot of venues and there were a lot of gigs. And we actually toured New Zealand a lot more than we do now.
With Everything That Flies?
Yeah, and other bands of that level, yeah.
You must have often been the only woman on the bill.
Yep, that's true. And it was really kind of overwhelming and interesting to be, and all of a sudden working with these women in the same band, because we were vastly different personalities and vastly different musical tastes. So it was interesting.
What was supposed to be just, a couple of fun gigs a year blew up into something quite unexpectedly successful, though.
Yeah.
Became a bit of a juggernaut, right?
I know. And weirdo little me had a few problems psychologically with it. I on one hand, really loved the performance, and I learned so much. I learned so much about harmony, about performance, and also about kind of standing my ground about who I am. It's easy for certain personalities to kind of meld into others, especially in a situation like that. So that was interesting for me. But the biggest problem I had with it, particularly towards the end before I left, was the fact that it was so popular and so many of my friends were in bands that weren't attracting audiences for their amazing original music. And, we were determined to do New Zealand songs in the set, which we always did, so that was a major part of the show. But I was still so conscious of the fact that we were basically doing covers. And, it's not a sin, but I kind of felt it was a little bit of a sin.
Yeah. I think many people wouldn't have realised at the time that something like Melting Pot was a cover. I certainly didn't growing up. I was 10 when that came out in 1988, and I had no idea until I reached adulthood that you guys didn't write that.
Yeah, that's often the case, isn't it? When you've got a favourite song and it is a cover, often a cover of a cover of a cover, and then you kind of realise where it comes from. It's quite a revelation.
You did sneak one of your originals into When the Cat's Away into their sets, didn't you?
Yes, that's well researched there, Kirsten.
Something good's got to happen.
Yeah, Margaret covered that actually in The Cat's Away, because I think it felt like, no, this is a covers band, so you can't do your own song. So my
right.
So yeah, Margaret covered that.
You were trying to establish yourself as a solo artist at that time. This is what, 1990?
Yeah.
How did that go?
Basically, I did release that song, Something Good, and it did chart. It was hung around on the charts for quite a long time.
It's a really catchy pop song.
Yeah, I think it's okay. I don't think it's the best song I've ever written, but I think I listened to it recently. It's not bad. It's okay. It's all right. I had a whole lot of songs at that time, and I was using my income from When the Cat's Away to actually fuel my other career of doing my own songs. And so I had been recording these demos with an Australian producer called Nick Mainsbridge, and I produced quite a few songs with him, and he was pretty fired up about it. He played them to some record companies in Australia and got some really, really great responses. One was from Sony in Australia. And Sony said, well, we really, really like this. We think because Diane has a profile in New Zealand, we should possibly do what we've done with Margaret and do a dual Australia-New Zealand deal. And Sony New Zealand said no. The deal didn't happen, and it made me angry enough to actually go and live in the UK.
That is irritating. Let's head to the next thing on your mixtape. Let's go with Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass, Lonely Bull.
So it might seem strange for me to select this song. There's actually two reasons. It's because I played a song that my mum really, really loved, and this one was one of my dad's favourites. And it's so evocative of the time when I was growing up. And there's another thing was that when we were in the UK, we were in the Julie Dolphin. We were signed to a record label called Timbuktu. We then ran into problems with litigation, all sorts of great
things.
Yeah,
we're
going
to hear more about that, I think, after this song.
Yeah.
Should we hear it? This is Lonely Bull. That's Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass, Lonely Bull. Your partner and musical partner, Brett Adams, also name-checked this song in another publication as one of his favourites. Is that what you two connected over, Herb Alpert?
Not really. Not really, but it was kind of significant in both our childhoods. I think it was just the era that we grew up. So the reason it's kind of significant for this life story is that, yes, it was in my background when I was growing up. It was one of my dad's favourites. But also we went on to sign to a band called the Boom Boom Mancini. We signed to Herb Alpert and Jerry Moss's label, Almo Sounds. So that was fairly significant for both of us.
So you went to London, you looked up Brett Adams, who used to be in the Mockers, and formed another band.
Brett had played on a few of my demos just before he went to London with the Mockers, and he was actually in early When the Cat's Away too, but we just had always clicked on a very musical level, and he played on these demos of mine, he just play the perfect stuff, and we really liked very, very similar types of music. So when I went to London, it was we just started writing together, and things really fell into place really quickly musically for us. Just felt like the right thing at the right time.
The Julie Dolphin, I believe, was named when you and Brett were making up names for cocktails.
That's one of the stories, yeah. It's just a really stupid name. And we have we have nothing to talk about. It's like we just called ourselves that and it stuck. You know, band names are just, man, it's just awful when you go and get into a new band. You think, what about this? What about that? And it becomes this horrible kind of weird cyclic thing.
You hate the name?
No, I don't hate it. It's just, it was just always really hard to talk about why we were called the Julie Dolphin.
So did people assume that you were Julie?
Often, yeah. But the funny thing is there is a singer in the UK that we did not know. She's an opera singer called Julie Dolphin, and she actually came to one of our gigs and introduced herself once.
Yeah, I accidentally looked her up on Apple Music yesterday.
Oh, really? Funny.
So what were you trying to do with that band?
We were just babes in the wood. We just wanted to form a band, and we just did. And we wrote and wrote and played and played and played. And we had no nous about the industry. We had no idea how difficult it would be. So therefore it wasn't, if that makes sense.
Were you working day jobs in London?
We were. I was cooking in bars, and Brett was cycle couriering, and all sorts of things. It was hard. But the fact that we seemed to do well pretty quickly kind of scooted things along quite easily.
When you say do well, what do you mean? What happened?
Well, it is a huge industry, and we got noticed pretty quickly. We just got into the local music press, the NME, the Melody Maker, Kerrang. We got noticed quite quickly, so that helped things a lot for the fact that it was really, really tough. London's a tough city if you're poor.
Can I read you an NME review from 1994?
Sure.
I don't know if you remember this one by Mark Sutherland, but it was, I think, about one of your shows at the London Camden Underworld.
Okay.
Says, the Pixies sure were a hell of a pop group, weren't they? Certainly the Julie Dolphin seemed to think so. The Boston Stormtroopers, Kim Deal-led numbers serve as the launch pad for the Dolphins' abrasive pop. But hey, everyone's got to start somewhere, right? So there were comparisons to the Pixies, first off, and I can hear that in your song Birthday.
Yeah.
It's a really good review, by the way.
Yeah.
Buoyed by fluid guitars and an abundance of skyscraping melodies that set them apart from most of the current girls fronting crunchy guitar bands contenders. New Zealand singer Diane Swan looks like a downbeat street urchin. Crap dishcloth skirt, haggard stare and greasy hair. But her throaty voice is more fierce than a cornered rat.
That was such a confusing... I remember that review. That was so confusing for me because I was like, thank you. Yeah, the UK music press, they never give you anything very easily. It's like...
Notoriously
give with one
fickle.
Hand and take it away with
exactly.
The next, right? Yeah, so he actually went on to give us some amazing reviews, and that was a good review, but it was just kind of confusing.
You had some high-profile support slots around that time, 1994.
We did.
Green Day, for a start, who were possibly one of the biggest bands in the world at that time.
Yep.
How did that come about?
We played at an MTV special show, and they were in the lineup. It was very interesting because we were sort of earlier on in the lineup. And when we were playing, we noticed these guys moshing down the front and realised it was actually the guys from Green Day. And after we played, they were like, Joey was like, my God, this song, did you know that the song is on high rotate in San Francisco on college radio? Mm-hmm. And we had no idea, absolutely no idea that that was happening. And he said, and nobody knows who you are, and now we've met you. That was pretty amazing. That was a pretty cool moment. Frustrating
moment.
Were you
sort of a mystery band, an enigmatic thing in the States?
Yeah, we were. it's the same old thing. We didn't have good management, so we couldn't cash in on that stuff. And, you know, even if it was maybe 2 or 3 years later, things would have been different as far as the internet and all that kind of thing goes. But at that stage, it still wasn't quite as easy to kick into those opportunities, you know.
The Pixies were an influence, obviously. You've got Mr. Greaves on your mixtape.
Yeah, I loved Doolittle, that album. Funny thing was, when I was listening to it, I was in the Cats Away, or it was just after, around that time. And I remember I just loved that album so much, and I could not stop listening to it, probably on my Walkman or Discman, probably. And I was touring around Australia doing backing vocals for Margaret Ulich, so I was in this heavy pop scene with these top-notch Australian session musicians. And we did this thing where we were driving around in the tour van, and we'd put an album on the stereo in the van. And I put on Doolittle. And I think the comment from one of the Australian session musicians was, yeah, well, a little help if they could take the guitars out of their cases before they played them. They just hated it.
I hope it got stuck in the tape player like it did in my car when I was 16.
That would have been justice.
Yeah.
Hope everything is all right. Hope everything is all right.
It's the Pixies, Mr. Greaves. Diane Swan is our mixtape guest today. You met Frank Black.
When we became the Boom Boom Mancini, we were playing at the 100 Club in Oxford Street in London, and playing away, and actually playing a song called Mess Up Your Life, which was probably another fairly Pixies-influenced song. Playing away, look up, and there's a gentleman standing there in a suit, and he's holding two bags, one bag in each hand of vinyl records, and he's watching us and nodding along, and it was Frank Black.
He looks a little bit like an undertaker or something.
Yeah. Okay. I tell you, I did a double take, because he just looked kind of out of place and then realised who it was.
Yeah.
We had a few friends in the audience trying to take selfies and kind of, you know, it was just this crazy
moment.
How
do you take a selfie in 1994?
Well, I guess it wasn't a selfie. It was just like a photograph with you in it. Like on film, probably.
Yeah.
But we do have a record of it. Our friend Craig, who took one of those photos, actually just posted it the other day, just as proof that it did happen. There was Frank and there's Barbara next to him, sort of thing.
Mm.
He had come along to the gig with the guy that was doing publicity for us at that time, who'd said, hey, come and listen to this band, you might like them. He consequently thought we were a good pop band, and he asked us to go on tour with Frank Black and the Catholics, and that was fairly exciting. And
So what year was this?
maybe 98, maybe.
Yeah. And so and you had changed, the Julie Dolphin had changed their name to Boom Boom Mancini.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah, we got into stupid situations with our first record company, and the name was in dispute. It was just a whole lot of really stupid things that, if we had have had good management, we probably wouldn't have found ourselves in the situation. Mind you, it's happened to so many bands, it's kind of almost becoming a boring story. But we ended up, I don't think we should have, we ended up changing our name to Boom Boom Mancini just to kind of free ourselves from that. It was pretty much the same band, but, you know, time had moved on as well, so the music industry had moved on and the scene had moved, so we kind of felt like we needed to move as well.
I think a lot of bands fell apart around that time, the late 90s. Yep. I mean, dance music, electronic music, that was the zeitgeist. That was what all the kids were listening to. You know, it really was that swifter sea change.
It really, really was. We didn't end up going on tour with Frank Black because his dad had a rafting accident and he pulled the tour. So that was one of it. we've got a whole story, a whole list of near misses, actually.
Yeah, tell me about some of the others.
We were booked on TFI Friday with Chris Evans, which was one of the biggest shows, TV shows on UK TV. Mm. It was on a Friday afternoon. And if you got on that show, you were very often, and you played a song, you were very often in the charts the next day. We fought like hell to get onto that show, and we made it. Apparently Chris Evans, he thinks he really likes the song, come along and do a live slot on that show. And that was so, so exciting. It was also the last show of the summer before the summer season kicked in and they went off air. And the day before, we got a call saying, hey, bad news, Aerosmith have come into town and want to go on the show. So you're off the slot, basically. So we didn't get to do
it. How frustrating. I bet you've never listened to Aerosmith again.
Never. I know. I mean, you can't dispute that, right? So that was kind of the beginning of a whole lot of things that kind of went pear-shaped. But,
Hey, we have skipped over one of the most prestigious gigs you ever had as well, playing, singing with Radiohead.
Yeah, that kind of happened further, you know, around 94, 95. We were playing, we were sort of supporting a band called Magnapop in Oxford, and a couple of the members of Radiohead were in the audience, and that led to, me being asked to come into the session, the Ben Sessions, to sing on a couple of tracks, and B, we ended up touring through the UK with them, I think twice, as their support act.
What were they like? What were your first impressions of them as people?
I obviously walked into a historically very tense session. the atmosphere was really, really tense. Everybody was really, really super nice to me. Tom was the one that ended up producing the vocals. I sang on a song called How Can You Be Sure?
And it was the B-side to Fake Plastic Trees.
Yeah, and so he was kind of in the control room and saying, okay, yeah, that was great, now sing again, but sing it like you would sing it, and little directions like that. It was great. They were lovely people.
So Boom Boom Mancini have an unfinished, unreleased album, is that right?
We do.
Is that ever going to see the light of day? Have you pursued it at all?
Look, I toy with the idea every now and then. Brett and I talk about it. You know, we could probably still release it. It's so of the time, though, of that late 90s sound. The songs are really good. The recording is incredible. Still don't know. It was just kind of painful, and that sounds so, I don't know, trite, but it was. We had this album ready to go. So many things fell over. It didn't come out. We'd been in the UK, slaving away from our families for so long, and we were poised, absolutely poised, and it didn't happen.
So 11, 12 years in the UK, and you came back to New Zealand.
Yeah.
Did you want to go into music here? Did you have other options? Because at this time, you and Brett were a couple as well. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, the decision to come back happened when we were back on holiday and we were at Bethel's Beach, and it was one of those crazy Bethel's Beach days where the wind was blowing the sea foam across the black sand and there was a blue sky and it felt like a different planet. And we thought, wow, imagine living here. I thought, oh, hey, we probably can. And so we decided to go back and save a bit of money and come back.
How were you saving money?
Well, we didn't save that much, actually. We were working, temping, so
yeah.
I was working at Channel 4 TV.
I believe it's at Channel 4 that you heard the next thing on your mixtape, Granddaddy.
Yeah, so I was listening to the album Software Slump by Granddaddy on my headphones while I was working at Channel 4 TV. It was a very empty office. It was kind of, I think, early afternoon. And as is legendary in offices in London especially, people probably at the pub, so it was a fairly empty office. But we all had televisions on our desks, so it was kind of like an office full of TV screens. And I had that song on my headphones, and I looked up the TV screen and I saw an aeroplane fly into a tall building, and was on September 11th. What was happening in New York at that time, and I looked up and I could not believe what I was seeing with the soundtrack that was in my ears. It felt like if somebody had have scripted that in a movie, that would be the track that you would play, because it was just the lyrics, the atmosphere of the song, it just, I will never forget it. And eventually people started drifting back into the office and I was going, wow, you should have a look. Look what's happening over in New York right now. It was unbelievable. And if you listen to the song and the lyrics, it's kind of quite astounding.
This is Granddaddy. He's simple, he's dumb, he's the pilot.
Solid ground, my friend. I heard all your controls were jammed. Well, it's just nice to have you back again. But I guess they still don't understand. And they can never understand. And they said go find 2,000 men. And they said tell you to give in. Are you giving in 2,000 men?
It's Granddaddy. He's simple, he's dumb, he's the pilot. I can imagine how time stood still for you at that moment where you saw those planes careering into the Twin Towers, 2001.
That is exactly the right thing to say. Yeah, time did stand still. And, yeah, it's pretty hard to hear that song not think of that moment.
Yeah. So you came back to New Zealand 2003 to live.
Yep.
Was it a relief to step out of the grind of trying to make it big in the industry, coming back to New Zealand with, you know, I guess, no plans?
It was very mixed for me. It was great to be here on this land, in this atmosphere, around friends and family. But it is a very strange thing to come back after you've been away for that long. People have moved on without you being around. You know, it's kind of like they just get used to doing things without you, but you're like, hey, I'm back, you know. It's a very odd thing. Mm. Plus also, music-wise, I didn't have a lot of idea of what was going on in New Zealand in the 90s musically.
Yeah, I mean, you both were quite in demand, you know, through the early 2000s as backing vocalists, guitarists.
Yeah, yeah, we did get a lot of work doing that stuff, yeah, which was great, really good. Life was so much easier here, and that, you know, life starts becoming important. You like, after a while you think, okay, yeah, ambitions are good, music's good, but life's important too.
Yeah. The Bads, it never occurred to me in, you know, however many years you've been a band, that it's actually an anagram for Brett Adams,
so
Diane
simple,
Swan.
Right?
Oh. I mean, it's such a great name for an alt country duo. It just never occurred to me.
Well, it could have been Disba, you know.
Yep. Tell me about the writing relationship between you and Brett. Do you butt heads over songwriting?
Hell yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Weird to be arguing about a seventh or a not seventh, you know, and really arguing about it.
Yeah, with most couples, it's, you know, who's doing the dishes. With Diane Swan and Brett Adams, it's got to be the seventh. It's got to be the ninth.
It's like, no, it's not. Sad but true.
There's a song of yours from 2013, California, and it's got a line about success. Can someone tell me what success is?
Yeah.
What does it mean to you, having gone through this whole, you know, highs and lows kind of career?
Well, I guess that's kind of what that song's about. It's just that it's kind of, you know, it's kind of advice to people that are younger, people that are kind of taking on this thing called music. It's kind of just go with it. And so to a lot of people, we're not successful. To some people, we are successful. To us, we're not successful. But, you know, we are successful in the way that we are still working and doing what we love and trying to live a life that we enjoy, you know. And that's changes over time, that view of what success is.
You're going to end your mixtape with a 15-minute Neil Young song, and we're going to play as much of it as we can, but tell me about why you've chosen this one, Change Your Mind.
Yeah, really sorry for selecting this. so recently I was involved in the Live Rust 40th anniversary celebration shows, which was just such a dream come true for me to be involved in. I've just been the hugest Neil fan my whole life. I say Neil saved my life because I really feel like he did. Just that his ability to express the human condition and also have the courage to not have that perfection and everything, have a bit of a rough edge, has been a great thing. I stumbled again on this. I had heard it, you know, when it first came out, but I stumbled on it again when I was studying up on the songs for the show. And I watched this live version of him playing with Crazy Horse. And it is just the most mesmerizing 11 minutes. And then I read up about the song, and I read that he had written it for Kurt Cobain. And apparently he was really, really worried about Kurt before he died, and he didn't get to him in time. And this song kind of talks about all those subjects.
And on that cheery note,
I love you, Neil.
Diane Swan, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you for coming in and talking to us and playing your songs.
Thank you so much.
This is Neil Young, Change Your Mind. When you get weak,
sound. You wait around and get the word.